Hi, I'm Diane Chandler.
And I'm Perry Grossman.
And this is Own Your Throne. Ladies, your life is not over. You are just at the beginning of reigniting and redefining your life.
And through this show, you will meet inspiring women who have recreated and redefined what it really means to thrive and age gracefully.
Our guests are some of the most inspiring women on the planet. We were honored to sit down with each of them and get real about their own journeys and what it took for them to truly own their throne.
Every Mother Counts founder Christy Turlington Burns' work in maternal health began after experiencing a childbirth-related complication in 2003, an experience that would later inspire her to direct and produce the documentary feature film No Woman, No Cry, about the challenges women face throughout pregnancy and childbirth around the world. Under Christy's leadership, Every Mother Counts has invested nearly $15 million in programs in Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and the United States, focused on making pregnancy and childbirth safe for every mother everywhere. Christy also received international acclaim as a model representing the world's biggest fashion and beauty brands. Christy's been featured on thousands of magazine covers, was one of Time's 100 Most Influential People, and Glamour Magazine's 2013 Woman of the Year. Okay, Christy, you're just basically a rock star. I mean, truly. I mean, you're, you know, a Renaissance woman. You're an international model, a supermodel. And I didn't even mention this. You've created other businesses. I mean, a skincare line, two clothing lines. You're also, not to mention just those things, a mom, a wife, a humanitarian, writer, a TV correspondent, let me catch a breath, and director. Yeah. And as we said, your directorial debut was with the documentary No Woman, No Cry, which focuses on maternal health. And you also created Every Mother Counts, as we talked about, in 2010, which is a nonprofit devoted to making pregnancy and childbirth safe for every mother. So would you mind telling us why? And we also understand your story, personal story of a complicated childbirth.
Yeah, I'm tired hearing all that about myself. So.
I know, I was going to go, hi.
Who is that person you're talking about?
Yeah. It's you, baby, it's you.
Yes, so my current work is leading this nonprofit organization, which I did start in 2010. We just entered our 10th year in this space. And the work was inspired by a personal experience after delivering my daughter. My daughter is 16 and a half years old now. So she is the sort of physical measurement of how long I've been invested in this work. I had an otherwise really uneventful pregnancy. I had a great pregnancy. I was really ready to become a mom when I became a mom. I had great healthcare and I had good options for choosing where to deliver and with whom. Really had a sort of dream scenario that I envisioned for myself. And my husband was a really, you know, wonderful supporter of my getting the birth experience that I really wanted for myself. It really was only after delivering her in a birth center in New York City within a hospital that things took a turn. And we were not prepared for what we experienced. I had an unmedicated birth, which was something that I had always wanted for myself. But of course, like most pregnancies, you just don't know. So I was preparing for that, but open to surrendering if I had no control over how things would go. But I did have that experience. And then in the, I don't know, hour or so after my daughter was born and she had latched on and was breastfeeding well. And, you know, I was just kind of, I don't know, I was on cloud nine, really. Mm. I was so ecstatic. I was filled with endorphins. I felt like such a warrior because I got the experience I wanted. And then the sort of vibe in the room changed. I didn't progress to my the third stage of labor, which is kind of a non-event for most pregnancies. I've witnessed birth before, and it's when the placenta is delivered. Nobody really spends a lot of time talking about the fact that that's like a whole other birth, essentially. But mine did not come out and it needed some help. And ultimately, we discovered that it had grown attached to the uterine wall. And so it needed to be extracted. And because I had an unmedicated delivery, I didn't have time to do anything for pain in that extraction. Oh. So it was a brutally painful experience. And having gone from those feelings of being a warrior to being on my back, having the OB who backed my midwife come in and sort of intervene and jump in to manage the situation, it all felt pretty scary for a little bit. But luckily, the team worked really well together, and I was fine. And I went home, you know, the next day and continued to sort of think about what had happened and felt a little, I mean, not only had I lost a few liters of blood, which wasn't the worst thing to happen, honestly. There's a lot of people who have to have blood transfusion with the same experience. But in just being home and trying to understand, I was confused by it. I talked to other friends and I learned that a lot of women have complications that they don't necessarily talk about with their friends mm-hmm. or their circles. And I started to hear that women had not only similar complications as the one I experienced and endured, but others even more serious than mine. I know it shook me a little bit in that, you know, we're not sort of helping one another prepare as well as we could for this experience and for the potential outcomes that don't go the way that they do on television or in movies, you know, where you have like three pushes and there's the baby and,
and you're glowing and you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah, it's all good. And so I started to just dig a little bit and I found out that that around the world at that time, hundreds of thousands of girls and women die every year from pregnancy and childbirth birth-related complications, and that those numbers really hadn't changed in decades. And I was shocked to learn this after becoming a mom. I thought, like, this is the kind of information you would like to know going in. I imagined, I'm sure like most people, that in the 21st century, that a woman dying in childbirth is a very, very rare event. And it actually isn't. Around the world, a woman dies every 2 minutes from a pregnancy or childbirth related complication.
Wow. And including the United States too, right? I mean, that's the shocking.
Yes, I'd say 1 to 2 women die per day in the United States, which is, it doesn't, I mean, it's every preventable death is one death too many compared to a place like Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, you know, where, you know, in some places like Niger, for example, I think there, a woman has a 1 in 9 chance of dying in childbirth. So almost everyone you meet, if you ask a group of women, have they known someone who has died? Almost everyone in a room would raise their hand. And I've seen that in a number of countries. But as you mentioned, the United States is probably the most shocking of the countries where we do work currently. We are one of only 2 countries with a rising maternal mortality rate, and we spend more on healthcare per capita than any other country in the world. We spend the most on maternity care than any other country in the world, and we're not getting the value.
Why do you think that is?
There's a lot of reasons for it. Our medical system is quite broken and has been for some time. And there's often a correlation between maternal mortality or morbidity, which is severe complications due to pregnancy and childbirth, and functioning health systems. So when you have a problem or there's a rise or an increase of maternal death, usually it points to the inadequacies of a system. So our system is very fragmented. It's very disjointed, the way that our insurance is set up and the way that so many women still have are lacking of insurance. You know, our country is large and it's complex, and each state functions as a country in and of itself in some respect. So you have the situation where women might move from one state to the next and their eligibility for Medicaid or whatever their coverage is might not be there, or there might be a gap in that coverage. And because of that, she's at risk. I think you probably remember the conversation before the American Affordability Care Act was introduced, that pregnancy was considered a pre-existing condition. So if you found yourself pregnant without insurance, this was a real problem. And more than 50% of pregnancies in this country and generally are unplanned. So there are a lot of people mm-hmm. that are finding themselves pregnant without having proper insurance or medical coverage. Yeah. So that's one big problem. Another is our chronic health conditions. You know, we have a big problem across the United States with very large numbers of obese women, diabetes, hypertension. Mm. We also have a system that's highly medicalized. And so, you know, you certainly want state-of-the-art medical care when you need it, but it's not always necessary, especially with a low-risk pregnancy. And so sometimes there are interventions that actually put a mom in a more dangerous position. Our C-section rate is incredibly high in our country, higher, I mean, maybe twice as high as what the recommended number should be, according to the World Health Organization. So there are a lot of factors. And then probably the biggest factor, which I hate to say to the last, but it is sort of the most glaring one, especially in light of the discourse across the country today, which is racism, which is explicit bias in our hospitals and institutions. Women of color are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy or childbirth related complication. And like even a African-American woman who is highly educated has a higher risk at having a complication than a low income Caucasian woman. So when, you know, when you hear the stories or when you see the statistics and the data that's out there and that's been out there for some time, you can't look away from the fact that there's clearly implicit bias happening. And that's also pushing people away. I mean, we had an amazing story come out of Serena Williams when she became a mom a couple of years ago. I think it's 2 years ago now, where, you know, here you have our most famous, most awarded athlete in the country who is African-American. And she had a chronic illness, understood that something was happening post partum. I think she had a C-section with her daughter and was very specific in what she needed to address what was happening. And she was ignored. Luckily, she had the voice to be able to get the healthcare to listen to her and to address the situation because she understood her body and she knew what was going on. But time and time again, there are reports of women who were not listened to that come in with really really clear symptoms that there's something very seriously wrong, and they are made to wait. They are told to be quiet. They are told to go home. And then subsequently, something serious happens. So it's something that I think there's been given a lot more voice to. Certainly, the media has spent a lot more time on digging beneath the surface. But it's something that, you know, we as an organization are very focused on, you know, on marginalized populations, which tend to have lesser access to quality care, quality and respectful care. And so that's one of the things we advocate most for.
Well, it's interesting when you were just saying that there are a lot more people they're digging now. They're looking more into it. Mm-hmm. And you've been the voice mm-hmm. of that. And when I was researching and learning about you, what I found so fascinating is you've had so many chapters of your life, from being a supermodel to a student, which I'm fascinated with, to being a mom and a wife and then a business owner and now an activist. And what inspires you to keep recreating every chapter of your life?
Gosh, I mean, I'm a curious person. I think that's probably one of the big things that I've had from a very early age. I think before my first career, which I kind of fell into as a model in my teens, I really didn't think a lot about what I was going to be because I was a kid. You know, I loved riding horses. I really valued my social friendships, you know, as you do in middle school. Yeah. And then suddenly, boom, I also loved to travel already at that point. My mom is from Central America. She's from El Salvador and came to the States when she was 8 years old. She worked for Pan Am Airlines. Okay. I have to say airlines because nobody even knows what Pan Am is anymore.
I do.
Remember the TV series with the blue round?
Yes.
My dad
is a pilot as well. So through both of them, I inherited a love of travel. And so for me, when I started modeling, the really most exciting thing about the job was that I got to travel so much. Mm-hmm. And because I had grown up traveling already, I was able to go and be on my own. So I, you know, independence and being able to just like pick up and go was, you know, really the most exciting thing in the world for me. But I also knew fairly early on that was a career that wasn't, I didn't know a lot about it as a career, but I knew that it was not something that was supposed to last. You know, whatever I knew about it, I knew that it was probably like very, very short lived. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking really early on. I didn't think of it as a career. I thought of it as an opportunity to have options. And I started thinking about going back to school really soon, pretty much as soon as I was not a student who was modeling and I was a full-time model in New York. I thought, ooh, that's not as interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what I want to be known as. So I started talking about going back to school and started taking classes here and there. And then by the time I was 25, I was like, okay, I'm ready to, you know, I wouldn't say I had to walk away because I was in a lucky position that I had some contractual relationships, which I still have today, which I'm quite proud of. But at the time, I just felt this is the time. If I don't do it now, mm-hmm. it's just going to get harder and scarier. And so I applied to NYU and I got in and I started that fall. And I was adamant that I do it in 4 years, just as any other student would do. And that was where sort of my world really opened up because mm-hmm. I was exposed to so many different subjects and I just mm-hmm. got to explore and become, you know, follow paths of interest. And that kind of helped me to the next place.
Well, and you do, you keep creating. I was really fascinated by this quote by Coco Chanel. And she said, beauty begins the moment you decide to be yourself. Now, as you talked about, you were a supermodel to your young teenage years, but did you know yourself back then? And did you feel like you were authentic to yourself back then as you are now? Or is that something that you learned later in life?
I mean, I would say I learned, I mean, I think you, it's sort of the process of becoming, right? Is what life is all about. So I would say I'm by far more authentic now, but I believe that I was authentic for who I was then too, you know, to the extent that I could be. You know, I definitely think that with experience and age and all of the things that, you know, you get hopefully closer to where you're, you know, to the goal, to the end point. But I feel like, you know, there's still such a long way to go. So I can't say I'm quite there, but I do feel like I'm living an authentic life. I feel that for the most part, I get to call the shots. And I feel like pretty early on, I was able to do that. Like I knew that I had options and I could make choices. And, you know, whether it be stopping work to go to school or slowing down with work to do that, or, you know, I just kept trying to create more paths for myself so mm-hmm. that if I got to an end of a road, I wasn't going to sort of, you know, freeze and think now what. I feel like even if my activism ended tomorrow, I have so many interests and so many things mm-hmm. that I would want to do. So yeah, boredom is something I haven't experienced since I was probably a very small child.
I love what you just said about curiosity, because we're finding that theme a lot in women that we've been interviewing that are super inspiring. And so many of them are like, curiosity is the key. Yes. Stay curious. You know, mm-hmm. have lots of interests, keep learning. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, I remember you from being a supermodel back in the 90s. And how did the one thing people say about you when I was sharing that we were going to be interviewing you is you're so grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, authentic is one thing, but you're really grounded. And did that come from the way you were raised, or is that a family trait, or do you think that's just innately who you are?
You know, I think about that a lot. I definitely think that I was lucky to be born into my family, and I had a, you know, pretty solid middle class upbringing. My parents, you know, were together and stayed together until my father passed away. And I'm one of three daughters between my parents, but my dad had been married before being married to my mom. So we have two half siblings as well. So I definitely, you know, grew up in a really, you know, close knit family. But I'm really more of a believer in nature than nurture in so many respects. I don't know. I keep questioning it, but I keep coming back to the fact that I think nature is nature.
Yeah,
and I think I am a grounded person. I'm a Capricorn.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, like I've guess. Always been like,
I love Cappies.
Earthy.
Mountain goats.
Earthy. Yeah. Yes. I love nature, and I love, you know, I love to be outdoors and I love to be active. And I feel like those things have helped me to stay grounded, even when I was, you know, traveling around the world and not staying in a country for more than a couple of days as a model. I learned very early on to practice yoga and to meditate. Mm-hmm. And I learned, you know, just to get outside and walk and to have my feet on the ground, like literally, if I was in a country. I learned to stay put if I got the opportunity to go to Africa or to be in a new country that I'd never been. I got advice early on to just extend my trip a little bit so I could explore and have that for myself. And all of that allowed me to have more of a connection to the people I was with, the places I was visiting, the culture. And that's something that I continue to really thrive on today, even in my work as an activist.
Sounds like it's part of a spiritual practice. And I was going to ask, you know, what is your spiritual practice? And then followed by, and it could be the same as, what feeds your soul?
So I grew up not particularly religious. My mom, being from El Salvador, she grew up Catholic. And so we grew up Catholic to some extent, but not rigidly so. Mm-hmm. My dad's family was less religious, but Christian. And then we moved from California to Miami, Florida for my dad's job with Pan Am in the late 70s. And that's where I got such an education about religion in the United States. It was so much more diverse than where I'd grown up. And, you know, a lot of my girlfriends were Jewish or were Baptist or Methodist or Lutheran. Like, if I would stay over with a girlfriend, I would go to church or to temple with them, you know, with their families. And I was fascinated by religion. In fact, when I went back to school to NYU, my concentration was on comparative religion. So it's been really a serious point of interest for me for a long time. And then with all the travel, I've gotten to see so much, so many practices. And then of course, with my yoga practice, which has been very much rooted in Eastern philosophy, I would say I love learning about every tradition and every ritual and every practice. I love seeing places of worship. I love seeing how people choose to worship themselves. Like, I love that about India. You know, you go into a home and everyone has their own little shrine and their own, it's so personalized. And I believe that that's what religion should be and what spirituality should be. But I really like that there's so much to take from all of it. And I would never, you know, think that mine or what I was born into is any better or more important than the next. So I guess I'm sort of, you know, a la carte, all of the things, but through a very, you know, a very consistent yoga practice, I think that has helped me sort of further develop that internally and understand like what is important to me, because yoga is about yoking and, or union with self or with those things and values that are important to you. And so for me, that practice is probably taking me the farthest in terms of, you know, becoming, in terms of living an authentic life, in terms of being as useful in the world as I possibly could be, and in keeping that connection with myself, with others, always. And so I maintain that to this day. And I imagine I will be practicing yoga till, you know, my last days.
You know, when you were just saying that to be useful, that's interesting, because I find that, and when hearing your story, it's not just that you experienced these things or went into it with a little bit of curiosity. Like, you made these your careers. You started a business. You started a yoga business. You became an activist for 10 years. So what is that? I mean, there's a curiosity, and then there's a deeper, is it wanting to change something, wanting to...
Calling?
Yeah, like a calling. Like, you really throw yourself all the way into something.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know if it's a calling per se. I think it's that setting an intention. And again, earlier, before that word is even something that I used, because I learned that kind of through yoga. But as a young person, I thought, I want to contribute in a meaningful way. And I didn't know what that would be until I set out. And then it was really through, you know, being exposed to so many different things, so many people who have really inspired me along the way. I don't think I've had any one sort of set mentor, but I've definitely taken little bits of things, and I've seen the people, I've seen friends of mine or people that I really look up to who have taken risks, who have been so committed to something so important, like a cause, and really made a difference. When I was first starting Every Mother Counts, I had made a documentary film first, and then after 2 years of being back in school for my master's in public health and finishing that film, that's sort of when it was, you know, really clear that that was the beginning of this next part of my life, not like at the end point. And at the time, I remember talking to some friends and saying, I really want to, you know, make maternal health something that we talk about, that people know. And I want to be like sort of synonymous with that. I want to represent something that is about wellness and is about taking care of others in our society. And I remember somebody asking, well, you know, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And that seemed so far away at the time.
Yeah.
You know, of course, from here, it's like a blip. I was conscientious of, like, you know, I was mindful of, you know, what I was doing throughout that time. But at the same time, I really was very present. And I wasn't thinking so much about what the next 10 years would be, or what would this, you know, what would this do for me in terms of, like, you know, my, my resume, or, you know, like it really wasn't about that. It was sort of following my heart and following, you know, the opportunities. And then, you know, again, continuing to ask that question, as long as I'm useful. So if sharing my story was useful and still is useful, because there's always new people that don't know my story. Yeah. And if my story helps somebody to say, oh, well, I've heard another story, or I know another woman who went, you know, like, it's just that kind of connecting the dots that's happened. Yeah. I mean, I can't say that it's all been very fluid. It hasn't felt like, okay, what's next? You know,
we said that last night.
I was just going to say, Diane and I talked about also the power of one voice, mm-hmm. and how much can be accomplished by one person. Sometimes we don't even know it, but sometimes some of our passions and callings come from our own experiences, like with what you had when you started Every Mother Counts. And then look what you've created just with your voice. And I think that's for our listeners to understand, is sometimes callings may seem so big and just paralyzing, like, oh my God, I can't do that. It's just one person, one voice. There's so much power behind it, especially when the energy of the universe is there, you know, and making it, because you're helping others. And that ultimately is what brings us, you know, so much joy.
And they're helping me, quite honestly. Yeah. You know, before I was advocating for maternal health, I had done some work in public health around tobacco cessation and prevention. My dad had lung cancer and passed away about 23 years ago. And I had been a smoker in my late teens and early 20s, I would say. And so that was my first kind of going out there, becoming really informed to become an expert in talking about a public health crisis. Mm-hmm. And then having that personal testimony from having been addicted myself to tobacco, but also having lost a loved one and watched that illness, which is not particularly kind. And so that gave me so much. It helped heal me when my dad had passed. I wrote a lot about this in my yoga book, but it really, I would say that loss and that experience and then the yoga practice is what really kind of brought me back to, like, okay, well, what can I do? Mm-hmm. Where do I start? Mm-hmm. And I think for the most part, humans want to be helpful. They want to be useful. They want to help other people. And it is overwhelming. There is a tremendous amount of need out there. And I always say to people, you don't have to have almost died in childbirth or lost a loved one yeah. through an illness for right. you to partake. You know, start with what moves you, what mm-hmm. brings you to tears. You know, when you watch the news at night, what's the story that gets mm-hmm. to your gut? Is it animal rights? Is it mm-hmm. is it racism? Does that make you so angry? Does it make you so mm-hmm. ashamed? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it? And then, you know, just one step at a time, learn as much as you can about that thing. And then, you know, you start to create a community around you of others who also believe as passionately about that issue as you do. And that sort of moves you in a different way. But I think, you know, I do think about, like, how one story and one person can make a big change, but it only becomes meaningful when it's in connection with other people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't do anything in a vacuum and really make the world a different place.
We said that even doing this.
Yeah,
I was like, I want to have a partner. I don't want to go do a podcast for myself. That sounds horrible. Like, it just doesn't sound fun to me. I want to be with my friend. Like, let's,
Well, it's girl tribe. It's girl tribe and the power. And we talk about that all the time in our shows and with guests, is how important that is. Okay, I have to change the narrative just a little bit, because I know a lot of our listeners are curious about, you have such a rock of a relationship with your husband, you know, Ed Burns, and it seems like it's just a powerful partnership. Is that how it is between the two of you? It just seems like you've enmeshed your lives together, and just stuff that I've read and heard and know about you, it's pretty inspiring. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, she turned red.
I feel lucky. I mean, we just celebrated 17 years of marriage.
Oh, congratulations.
And we've been together for about 20 years, or in August it'll be 20 years. And yeah, I do feel like he's very much my partner. I think when we met, we were in our early 30s, and we were both at a place where, like, we were ready to be serious as soon as we met. You know, we'd gone through other relationships, and all of a sudden it was like, okay, like, this is where we're at. And, you know, we actually got engaged quite quickly and then planned to get married and then had to postpone our wedding because of 9/11, and then broke up and then got back together and then got pregnant and then got married. So our whole thing was kind of, I don't know, out of sequence, I would say, but there was something about that that made it really work for us. You know, my husband just lost his mom a few weeks ago. And so in just, this is like one of those first big things that we've gone through, the birth of our children, of course, and our parents getting older, but that was a really big thing to go through as a married couple, and to be able to have gone through it myself when I was much younger with my dad, to be able to be there for him in the way that I could be, and to let him just be, not have to worry about anything else, and just pick up the slack. I felt like that felt like a test in a marriage in a such a good way that you just don't know until you get there. So yes, like today, for example, I had this conversation with you all. And so, you know, we both have fairly flexible, you know, workday structures. He's writing something right now. And so, you know, you've got to take Grace and I've got to take Finn. And I'm, you know, it's just, we feel like there's a balance and we really do share the load most times. And when I travel, you know, because I love to travel and I work to travel and travel to work, he's more of a homebody and he likes to be the steady Eddie that's grounded at home and he can do anything. Like, he doesn't need, you know, micromanaging, although I try.
I think that's fantastic.
You know, I have these long lists, or I used to anyway. I've kind of given up on them. I don't think he ever looked at any of them. It's like, yes, okay.
Yes, honey.
Got this. But because of that, he's really always been able to do everything that he needed to do. And I think that's empowering for him. That's really empowering for me to be able to go and not be worried and stressed. And then it's been so wonderful for our kids to be able to have one parent at a time sometimes to develop their like one-on-one relationships. And I mean, I have a daughter and a son, and to me, I am always mindful of the fact that both sexes need, or all sexes need, you know, those models of like, what does it look like? How does it, what does it look to share responsibilities, and that, you know, dad is washing the dishes and mom is on a job and gone for a week, you know, like, I think that's just really important so that we can start to change the way that, you know, that these perceptions, these perceived identity.
Right?
That's true partnership.
Yeah, it is. So I want to move this a little bit to what we had spoken about last night. I have four daughters, and Perry has a daughter, and you have a daughter. And we were saying raising girls in this time, and the challenge with social media and the attention to beauty and to being so connected
and perfect.
It's just, there's a conversation going on, and my daughters are 25, 23, 21, and 13. Harry's are teenagers. So the 13-year-old, I'm seeing a huge difference in raising her. She's a stepdaughter, a huge difference in raising her compared to my older girls. Like, it's exponentially gotten harder and more difficult.
Just because of social media.
And just how fast things are going. So how are you navigating that?
I would say you're an expert with four daughters.
And I'm from four girls.
Well, it's been interesting. I have to say that's one of the silver linings of this COVID time, where we've been, you know, so, you know, locked in together, in that I've sort of, you know, I had a more fear about social media than the reality of it, now that I've been able to watch and observe my daughter daily. And it could also just be who she is. So she's 16 and a half. She's going to be a junior next year. And I mean, there's a fair amount of TikToking, I will say.
Yes. My daughter's doing the same age, same thing. It's like, oh my.
I think how it's true. I think we can't beat it. I think you've just got to figure out how to manage it. You know,
yeah. I'm hoping you had some advice.
Like everything, there's positives too from it. Like, my daughter's also been cooking a lot during this time, and she gets all these recipes From TikTok.
From TikTok. Yes.
Who would have known? And so, you know, I don't have it. So I have it, but friends of mine have said, and I've tried to do this in some instances. It's just like, it's an overwhelming amount to keep up with, but my son games a lot. So a lot of people have said, you know, sit down and do it with them.
Right.
So that you understand it to like, it, you might not love it, but you will at least understand the language and the world that they're in. And so by not like trying to restrict the TikToking, I have like, sometimes I've been in the background. I've participated on occasion.
I love that.
All of your friends doing, like families doing full TikToks. But just so that I can kind of be there with her. And that goes for also watching some pretty crappy television at times or bad movies. But you just want to like, that time is so important to just check in with where they are and understand that, yes, our worlds are very different. And you can always try to find some comparison of like what would have been the equivalent in, you know, when I was 16. But honestly, by the time I was 16, I was already gone. And so I'm just really enjoying the fact that I still have her and that we've had this time together and that, you know, I think silliness is really important too. Like, I think you should be able to be silly with your parents and to have a sense of humor. And so I'm trying to, I don't think go overboard. I don't want to be like her best friend or have her friends think that I'm cool, but I I want them to feel like they want to be with me.
Yes.
And that they would want to be home at our house versus somebody else's house.
Right.
And that's happening so far. So I feel like, and I mean, obviously with more than one daughter, that's going to be harder. It's harder for me with my son right now because I just don't get the gaming thing at all. But we found like music is a common interest or, you know, just his sense of humor as he's been kind of blossoming as a young teenager himself in this last few months. Yeah. Paying attention.
I know.
It's just,
How do you balance it all, Christy? I mean, I have two kids too. My son just graduated from high school. And so it's, my time is a little different. I'm not having to take care of two so much, but how do you balance? Diane and I were sitting there talking last night. How does she have time to do this all? I mean, there's so much that you're creating and you're such a on purpose mom. What would you say to people listening is your secret or best tool or idea about how you can balance a lot between, you know, being a mom and being a professional?
I mean, I think I give myself a break. You know, I don't think of myself as perfect at anything. I try my best. I try my best every day. I know that like my ultimate goal is to be my best self and my, like, I want to be my best self as a mom, my best self in my career, my best self as a partner to my husband, but I'm not always my best at all of those things every single day. So, trying to have, I hate the word balance because I think it really does kind of it's also like happiness. Like you kind of don't arrive at happiness and stay there. I don't think you arrive at balance and stay there. Mm-hmm. It gets constantly like things are shifting and moving. I like integration because I think that's what I've really done. Like I know what my priorities are. Since becoming a mom, it became even more clear. Like life is short. Like I have only so much time. And then my work now is so rooted in my becoming a mom. So to me, it's just it's an additive. And I used to say when I first started that, you know, gosh, my real goal with Every Mother Counts is by the time my daughter is of the age that she is thinking about or considering whether to become a mom or not, that this is no longer the problem that it is today. And I hope that she's still like a good 16 to 20 years away from that.
Yes,
I get that.
but you know, it's just this idea that like, I'm trying to change the world that I live in, but I also want to see that change be sustained through her life, through her daughter's life, hopefully. So that's been fairly easy. And then my friendships, you know, I've also been able to build new, like there was a time as a new mom that I thought, I don't have time for any new friends. I can barely spend time with the people that I already love and care about. But somehow, like when you have more than one child, love grows, right?
Yeah,
and you make time. You know, you meet somebody, someone kind of really makes an impression, and then suddenly that person is in your life. And, you know, I've had a lot of women that I've been inspired by and I've gotten to meet in the last decade or more, and then they've gotten interested in the work at Every Mother Counts. And then, you know, like Stephanie Prankio has come with me to Guatemala. She's traveled me multiple times to Haiti. And then, you know, when you travel with a friend, you become even closer with that shared experience. So now my social world and my sort of circle of women who are also like activists and working hard on behalf of Every Mother Counts, they're like, I talk to all of them almost all the time, whether it's by text or, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, but we are in constant touch. And I still could meet people and bring them into that. Like, I don't find that there's a moment where that door is going to close. And I think that's a nice thing too, as you get older, that at different phases of your life, you can still, you know, keep an open mind and keep, you know, a little bit of space for new people to enter.
I love that so much, because I meet people all the time, and I'm a people person. So I love, my friendships mean a lot to me. And it's so interesting when you do run into someone going, no, I don't have room for more people in my life. I'm always like, wait, you might meet the most extraordinary person like at this point in your life. So I get that. I love that about you.
And by the way, I have to give a shout out to Stephanie. And I know you were a big influence in her daughter Lena's life, who's now a doula. Yeah. And that came from Stephanie's and your relationship. And I saw all of that grow. And she's still... are you still doing the trips, the mother-daughter trips?
Well, we have been. I don't know when we're going to be able to travel.
I know, right?
But we have been doing mother-daughter trips, and we've actually had some mother and sons too. Yeah, Lena is an incredible young woman, and I've just been so impressed. Of course, not surprised, because look at her mother.
Of course. Ship off the old block. I know.
I mean, she really is like, she, you know, has an idea and then she really does follow it. I really, you know, I feel like I was doing that early on, but I was also deeper in a career, I guess, at the point that she is in now. And I was just starting to like make that space to go back to school, and she did it in the other order. And she was like, where can I go next? And how can I be of use and of purpose?
Yes.
And she, I think, is really doing that.
She is.
I can't wait to see how she continues to evolve.
Oh my gosh, you and I both. It's amazing when you see your friends grow and what they create. Okay, I'm gonna go into a different subject, because I know a lot of women are listening and thinking, how is the aging process for you?
I've been asked about aging since I was literally 16.
You're getting old here, right?
And then also being in a career where I've represented beauty brands and fashion brands for so long, you know, airbrushing and those kinds of things has been around since I started. So I think I was, you know, airbrushed as much young when I didn't have wrinkles as now when I do. Now I can tell at least companies are trying to keep some in there, because I still work for Maybelline, and I started working for them when I was 22, and I work for Calvin Klein still. And I started working for Calvin Klein when I was 18. So what I like about that is that it shows that the companies also understand that their customers are growing and changing, and that, you know, that it's okay to sort of celebrate women at different stages of their life. And that, you know, that's beautiful too. It's hard for me to think about it without my career. You know what I mean? Like, I try to be objective, and I really can't. Like, I know too much, so I don't fall for any of the kind of advertising, you know, oh, if you use this cream, you won't have this blemish. Like, I don't believe any of it. I don't believe any of it, even if it works, because I guess I know too much about the smoke and mirrors that happens behind the scenes. So it's hard for me to sort of think about myself if I didn't have that knowledge or that experience. I'm gentle with myself. I know that age is just a part of life. I embrace it. I feel healthy. That's what I think is the most important. I'm more active as I call myself an athlete now, because now I've run 8 marathons. I've run probably 20 half marathons, all for Every Mother Counts. This is stuff that I never would have thought that I could do in my 20s even. Mm. And so I don't feel limited or as if there's not still a lot to be that I can do. I feel physically really strong. Mm-hmm. I think also giving birth, you know, made me also believe that, oh my gosh, this is like, I can do anything. I can give birth. I can do anything. I feel comfortable with aging. That doesn't mean that there's not some days that I'm like, oh, you know, you could just be looking at yourself every day the same way that you do when you brush your teeth. And then suddenly you're like, I see something that I didn't see yesterday or last night. But I don't get fixed fixated. I won't allow myself, even like, you know, when we take pictures and, you know, everyone's sort of editing all the time on their phones and deleting the pictures they don't like, I've learned that, like, give something a day or two.
Yeah.
And whatever it is that you just did, you will like it better. I promise you, Mark. I promise you. And you certainly will in a year or in five years.
Yes.
So don't just try not to erase what we don't like. Mm. I just think that it's not healthy. Mm-hmm. It just takes a little bit of time to adjust, mm-hmm. I think, as we're changing. You know, we get attached to our former selves at every stage. I get mm-hmm. attached to my children and at their various stages. But every stage that they've left, I like where they are now better than the one before. So why can't we give ourselves that same amount of grace and forgiveness?
That's a great analogy. I like that.
You know, I keep hearing the word as you're talking, just expansion, like everything in your life. It feels like, you know, it's not as much a new chapter of reinvention. It's just expansion and expansion of your life and expansion of motherhood. And it's just, to me, that is what you represent, as someone that's just expanding and becoming more conscious in every area of your life.
I like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, yeah. I have
another. I'm going to use that. I'm going to take that.
Expansion. Yeah, expansion, awakening. But it's like, that's what, as we're talking, it feels like that. It doesn't feel like you've really ever reinvented as much as you've just expanded and become more conscious.
Yeah.
You know, so
that's a beautiful way of expressing that.
Yeah.
So most women in their 50s or 60s, you know, we tend to slow down a little bit. There's that mindset of, oh my God, I'm getting older. Where's my rocking chair? Well, that's my point is, you know, you seem to be ramping it up more. And what keeps that energy in you going? And that, what is your mindset that keeps you going instead of the idea of slowing down, the idea of, you know, creating more, expanding more?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I were to look at my first sort of model in terms of that is my mom. And my mom, she's 80 and she, you know, she still practices yoga. She still goes on hikes. I've just always seen her kind of do a lot. I mean, she didn't work when I was growing up, but she volunteered a lot and she, you know, had lots and lots of friendships that were really her, where she focused her time and attention. And I would say her and so many other friends of mine, I've always had friends that are very diverse in age too. And so I've not experienced people slowing down in their 60s and 70s, honestly, unless something happens, which, you know, prevents them from being able to really move. I think each decade really does sort of open different opportunities. And, you know, I guess if anything, my practice, because I do tend to make myself busy and get kind of caught up in busyness, is to really like consciously slow down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Consciously. Like I have the opposite. Like I really want to, you know, it's never, I mean, I feel always like I have energy because there's always so much to do. So for me, in order to think about preserving that energy or going a longer distance, I just have to be a little bit more careful, you know, so that I can do all the things that I want to do.
Yes. Yeah. And I was, you know, it's interesting because I believe the same thing. My mom is 84, same way. She walks about 5 miles a day and super active. And I do think that there's something about, I think the aging process, staying healthy, like what you're eating, if you're keep, you know, if you don't move it, you lose it, right? So it's really about keeping moving. And I think that it makes it more gentle, a more gentle process. And that's part of what this show is about too, is that we really want people to shift the mindset or shift the conversation around ageism or what this is supposed to look like. Because whatever we believe 60 or 50 is supposed to look like, is what's going to happen, right? So it's really like keeping an open mind to what the next chapter is. And as long as we have breath in our bodies, we get to create.
We get to keep going.
Absolutely.
And I think we have more role models around us now that are showing that they're sort of busting through any kind of myths about what you can do and what you can't do at any age. Which I think is really healthy. I think you have to see something in the culture in order to know that that's possible for yourself. And then to know that each of us are models for our families and our
children.
And our girls.
You know, we all have influence in that sense.
All right. We have one fun game we came up with last night. I know. We like being just a little mischievous. So the game is, we're going to talk about each decade in your life. And when we say a certain age, just create or say one word that you think represented that decade of your life. So starting with your from 0 to 20, what would be the word?
Oh, gosh. Independence.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. How about 20s?
Travel.
30s.
Marriage. Mm. Family.
40s.
Every Mother Counts and my maternal health work.
Mm. 50s. Well, just the first year of 51.
Reflection.
Mm. I love that. That's so awesome. Just in reading about you and what we know, those words fit. I mean, it just really resonates with you.
What brings you the most joy?
I mean, I would have to say my family, but I have so much else that makes me joyful too. But yes, that's my here and now. And that's what I spend the most of my focus and my time on today, certainly. Mm-hmm. My family.
Your family. Okay, that's actually not the last question. The very last question we ask everybody is, the name of our show is called Own Your Throne. So when you think about owning your throne, what does that look like for you?
I guess it would mean, you know, being in a position of, I hate to say power because I've been thinking so much about the need to dismantle power and structures of power and patriarchy and mm-hmm. all that's been in my mind so much lately. But I would say it's more that kind of, you know, sense of self, mm-hmm. you know, with a capital S, like, you know, all of the elements, allowing ourselves to be as, again, I guess it's that kind of expansion, like seeing myself and allowing me to be in a place of like, being as much as I can be, like the most, mm-hmm. like the capacity, like filling my full capacity of me as a human being on this planet right now. Mm-hmm. And I feel for the most part, most days that I am doing that I, you know, I have a strong sense of self and purpose and know what I need to do to mm-hmm. keep feeling this way.
That's awesome. I mean, you honestly have the highest vibe of anyone we've ever interviewed. I mean, it's great. Yeah. Like, seriously, you do. It's just been a pleasure to interview you today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I know. Thank you, Christy. And is there anything that you want to add that we didn't cover that maybe could be helpful to our ladies who are out there? And especially at this time, you know, it's a tough time. It's a tough time around the world. We're dealing with a lot. And, as you're going through it with your family, is there any advice or suggestions or things that have helped you, tools, actions, as your whole family's been going through this difficult time?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to, again, be gentle with ourselves. And there's a lot of talk about self-care, and it almost can take away what the real meaning of that is. But I think really do your best, but also make time for yourself just to be just you and not always doing and caring for others. Cause I think that's something that most women, you know, it's mm-hmm. like we come last. And I think the analogy of the oxygen on an airplane is so important always to remember that you have to do that for yourself first before you can actually help your child or the person next to you. So really taking those moments. I, throughout this time with so much uncertainty, I have just been so, like, I run 3 days a week outside, rain or shine. I do yoga 3 times a week, and just keeping that time and that space carved out for myself no matter what. That's really been, you know, my kind of, you know, my respite, my my sanctuary. And I would be doing it probably if we weren't in this situation, but I felt like it's been more meaningful and more needed mm-hmm. in this time,
mm-hmm.
You know, creating some structure and having that structure sort of based upon self time, you know, needing that sort of away, just headspace really.
Mm-hmm. That's great. We thank you so much for your time. Yeah, I know you're a busy lady and thank you. We've learned so much from you and it's been a joy for us.
It's been awesome. Thanks.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in person. Thank you both so much. Good care.
Bye, sweetie. You too. Lots of love. Wow.
Yeah, she's She's incredible.
Isn't she amazing?
Yeah. I loved everything she said. She's just super wise.
Yeah. I think the two takeaways for me is how much she emphasized self-care. And it really is true. And I think we heard the different ways that she talks about self-care and authenticity for me. Those are the two takeaways.
For me, it was about what keeps her curious is really her curiosity.
Yeah.
Her connection to friends.
Yes.
I loved that. Yes. There's always space for more. Yeah. And really, I think the most powerful thing she said, and I caught it in one of her sentences where she said, how can I be of use? How can I be of service? And it reminds me a lot when we were at USM and our teacher speaking about, you know, the highest vibe on the planet is to be of service.
That's where greatest
highest,
joy.
Yeah. The highest frequency on the planet is to be of service. So for me, when she said, how can I be useful? It's almost this innate sense inside of her.
Yeah.
That's what drives her.
And I think that's a good lesson for all of us, especially during this time, is as people are going through depression or they're going through loneliness or they're going through, you know, attitude is so much about me, 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 me. The greatest way to get out of that and to move out of that is to be in nature, to move your body. Mm-hmm. And as you said, to be in service, go help somebody else. You know, and how can you be of service to somebody else and your passion, you know, create that. And then it takes your mind off of just you and some of the negative feelings that you're feeling.
Yeah. And I also was blown away. I mean, she's extraordinarily beautiful.
Yes.
But very natural and very comfortable in her skin. And you can see that the way her yoga practice, her running, her athleticism. And I think that's all part of, and for the listeners, you know, it's all part of feeling fabulous at every age.
Right.
As you get older, don't say, oh, I can't do this because. Yeah. Like, get your butt out there and try something new.
Yeah. In talking about her ageism and the thoughts of it, that there is no thought about it. It's like, it just is what it is, accept it. And I love her analogy about, you know, she sees her children growing from stage to stage to stage. Why not look at ourselves that way? Have you ever done this where you look at a picture of yourself, let's say 5 years ago, you saw a picture of yourself and you're like, oh my God, I look so terrible. And what happened to here and the gray hairs and da, 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 da. And then 5 years later go by and you look at, damn, I kind of looked good back then.
Oh, my girlfriend who's a top photographer says she cannot stand photographing women because we're so hard on ourselves.
Yeah.
And that she said, every woman looks at her picture. I don't care who she is, how old she is. She always picks it apart. And 5 years later, she comes back and she's like, damn, I look good. What was I complaining about? She said, it happens all the time.
So ladies, I think the thought is just be in the moment.
Yes, accept
and love yourself and be authentic and go out there and make a difference in the world and you'll be happy.
And I'd say the word from this show is expansion.
Loved that. That was awesome.
Yeah, it hit me like a ton of bricks because she really lives that. She lives what I think of as Eastern philosophies of the belief of consciousness and awakening. And I think she's an absolute example of that.
She is. All right, ladies, go out and think of the way you can expand your life.
Yes.
Bye for now. We'll see you next episode.
This podcast was created by Perry and I because we both met at school getting our master's in spiritual psychology, where we learned the tools and techniques to really heal, reclaim, and redefine the second chapters of our lives.
And you'll also learn some tools and techniques from our guest. All you have to do is go and subscribe and leave some comments. Let us know what you think about the shows, as well as maybe you have some ideas of other guests that we could have.
So enjoy the conversations, and we look forward to hearing from you.
And be sure and check out our website, which is ownyourthrone.co. And we have some freebies for you, so be sure and check us out.